All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Angela Davis, and you're listening to NPR News. Each Wednesday, I talk about wellness. And today, I'm talking about something that has a lot of people concerned. It appears that many people are drinking more during the pandemic. Recent studies show alcohol consumption has increased dramatically, especially among women. In a few minutes, a doctor who specializes in addiction and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous will join me. First, I want to share a conversation I recently had with NPR chief meteorologist Paul Huttner about what we know to be true about snow in Minnesota. Many of us are still kind of stunned by how early we saw a significant snowfall this season. I recently talked with Paul about what we traditionally see with snow in Minnesota. I started off by asking Paul, how much snow does the Twin Cities usually get on average each winter season? And here's what he said.
A lot of variability year to year, but if you add it all up, the National Weather Service keeps track of what we call 30-year averages. So for the latest set of 30-year averages, 54 inches is the average annual snowfall for the Twin Cities. It varies a lot, though. We've had as little as 14 inches back in 1930 and 31, and as much as 98.6 in 83, 84. I don't remember if you were here that winter. I remember it vividly, Angela.
I had not arrived just yet, but yes, I've heard the story many, many, many times. And what are the snowiest and the least snowy places in Minnesota? Because there's a lot of range across, you know, the state from northern to central to southern Minnesota.
You're right, there is. And generally, it's least snowy in southwest Minnesota and snowier in the north and east. So 54 inches on average in the Twin Cities. Duluth is 86 for the annual average. International Falls way up north, about 71. You go into southwest Minnesota, and it's about 40 to 50 inches down around Laverne. They have a lot of winters where they might only get 30 inches. And then you get up toward Lutzen and Finland, which is on the hill up above the North Shore. They can get 70, 80, 90, even 100 inches of snow typically. And there's a reason for that. They get the storms that come through, like we all do in Minnesota, but they also add lake effect, a lake enhancement, where it draws some moisture off of Lake Superior, and then orographic lift, where those winds come off the lake, they rise up that hill. That hill goes about 1,000 feet above the lake level, and that squeezes out extra moisture, so they can actually enhance those snowfall totals that way.
And because everything is different in 2020 because of the pandemic, Paul, don't you feel as though more people will welcome the snow this season? Because, you know, not as many people may have to drive in it, but also, you know, I think people will be looking for an opportunity for outdoor activities. And so with snow on the ground, you know, you have the option to do some snowshoeing, some cross country, or just, you know, take walks in the snow.
Yeah, that is a great question, and it gets me thinking, Angela. I think people are going to be of two minds there. Like you say, there are a lot of Minnesotans who love snow. They love to see it. They love to get out and play in it, whether it's snowmobiling or cross-country skiing. The resort industry loves snow, right, in northern Minnesota, because they get people to come up and play in the snow. And then I wonder about people who just feel a little cooped up, right? Because hopefully we all got out a lot this summer.
Right.
But then with the snow this winter and the way we're living through this pandemic, I wonder about some folks as well. So I always encourage people to get outside. But I think you're right. I think the majority of Minnesotans will appreciate the upcoming snow this winter.
That's true. It does make it harder to take a walk in the snow if you're concerned about the icy sidewalks or the trails just not being as safe for you as it is in the summertime.
Yeah, and that is a consideration for many Minnesotans. You know, Angela, I hear everything, right, in terms of our audience, because they will talk to me about what kind of weather they like and don't like. And older Minnesotans are concerned about the ice, and it is difficult to get out there in winter, and it is a safety issue. And talk to the hospitals when we get an ice storm or a real icy period, and you see they get a lot of slips and falls, so that is a concern during the winter months.
So jumping ahead to Christmas, the chances for a white Christmas, which I guess technically you need like an inch of snow on the ground for us to call it a white Christmas.
That's absolutely right. 1 inch of snow depth. And in the Twin Cities, that happens about 71% of years historically.
Oh, we usually do.
Those snow records go back to the 1880s. So there's a pretty long record there. Duluth, it's more of a slam dunk, 98%. Boundary Waters, northern Minnesota, 100%. There is not a year on record where they have not had at least an inch of snow up in far northern Minnesota. You work your way south, St. Cloud, it's more like 74%. Fargo, Moorhead area, 84%. And Laverne in southwest corner of Minnesota, about 64%, a 64% chance, or in 64% of all years, they've had at least 1 inch of snow depth in the southwestern part of the state on Christmas.
And Paul, I know you like to talk about climate change and you study this. And, you know, do you feel that Minnesota can still get some heavier snows now with climate change?
Yeah, and this is really interesting, Angela, because it's kind of counterintuitive, right? We know that Minnesota is warming up in the winter, about 5 degrees on average since 1970. So you think, well, we'll get less snow, right? Well, actually, it's just the opposite, because we're still warm enough that we can get snow. We're still below freezing most of the winter. And in fact, we get some of our best snowstorms between about 25 and 30 degrees. So if you look at that, it's almost an optimal snow environment many days. There's more moisture in the atmosphere. That can actually lead to heavier snow. So there is a scenario where our winter climate warms and our average annual snowfall actually rises. So that's something to watch as a trend as we go forward.
And Paul, again, you said we've warmed up about 5 degrees since the 1970s here?
In winter, yes. Winter is the fastest warming season due to climate change in Minnesota. And that's because the nature of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it re-radiates the warmth in the atmosphere. So we tend to stay warmer on winter nights. We warm less in the summer, but the bottom line is winters are milder, but it's still plenty cold enough to snow in Minnesota.
And Paul, because of distance learning, we know that teachers and parents are trying to get creative with what we're doing with kids. And, you know, getting them outside in the snow over the winter could be a good way to just, you know, take a break, but also do a little science. And I know that there are different types of snowflakes. And so maybe that's something that we can jump into this winter. Can you tell us about the different types of snowflakes and how they form?
Sure, and I learned a lot about this from Dr. Kenneth Librecht, who's a Caltech physicist. He's a North Dakota native, and he studies snow crystals. He actually grows them in the laboratory, so this is pretty cool. And you know those starry ones we're all familiar with. Those are called stellar dendrites. They're the most recognizable snow crystals, and they tend to form at temperatures around 5 degrees Fahrenheit, and then it warms up a little bit. You get these columns and needles that you sometimes see.
Yeah.
There's capped columns. There's these fern-like stellar dendrites. There's diamond dust crystals when it gets super cold. So
The
kinds of snow we get depend on the temperature and moisture environment that the snowflake is forming in. So really fascinating stuff. And if you go on the Updraft blog and Google snow crystals, you can find some writings I've done about it, and also go to that Caltech site. It is fascinating, and they have a lot of great pictures there.
You make me want to break out some scissors and some paper and try to, you know, make the snowflakes.
Absolutely.
The
Why not?
When do we typically see the last snowfall in Minnesota?
Yeah, and that's interesting, too, because that's been changing. April, as you know, the last 3 years, we have just been whacked with big snowstorms and blizzards. And our April snowfall has risen in the past decade from 2.4 inches on average to 7.1 in the last decade. So we usually would say we'd see our last snows in April and we get about 2 inches of snow on average. Well, now it's more like 7 inches, and it seems a little dicey as to if we can get through in April without significant snow. So I used to say that by the first week of April or so, we're seeing our last flakes, but lately it seems to be pushing a little later into the season because, again, as climate shifts, we get these extreme changes from week to week, from month to month. So we can get extreme warmth and extreme cold in April, and that cold usually keeps it cold enough to snow a little bit.
My birthday is on May 1st, which I know you have that marked on your calendar. But
I do.
It has snowed a couple of times on my birthday. I mean, just like flurries, like early in the morning. On some of my birthdays, I've awakened and cried because it was snowing.
I hear you. Well, Angela, I'm going to do everything I can to make it a beautiful, warm day for you this next year on your birthday.
It's okay. Yeah. Hopefully 2021 will have some surprises, some good surprises for us.
I hope so, thank too.
Thank you for your time for this lesson about all things snow in Minnesota, Paul. I appreciate it. That's NPR's chief meteorologist, Paul Huttner, joining us from the Weather Lab. And you can listen to Paul's climate cast on Thursday afternoons on All Things Considered here at NPR News. Also, check out the Updraft blog at nprnews.org. You're listening to NPR News, and I'm Angela Davis. One of the challenges many people are facing right now during the COVID-19 pandemic is limiting their alcohol consumption. Yes, a lot of folks are drinking too much these days, and it's because many of them are using alcohol to deal with the stress in their lives. Studies show that Americans are consuming alcohol 14% more often during the pandemic. For women, those numbers are even higher, showing a 41% spike in instances of heavy drinking. Now, we know when alcohol becomes a crutch to escape the stress of daily life, it can be dangerous. So this hour, I have a doctor who specializes in addiction and a man who's been in recovery for decades joining me to talk about the signs of a problem and how to address them. And I certainly want to hear from you. Do you have a question about how much is too much if you drink alcohol regularly? Are you concerned about a loved one who may be drinking too much during the pandemic? Are you in recovery and having an especially hard time right now? Give us a call. The number is 651-227-6000. Again, 651-227-6000. Tweet me at Angela Davis, NPR. On the line right now, we have Dr. Joseph Lee. And Dr. Lee is the medical director for Hazelden Betty Ford Youth Continuum. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Lee. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you. Great being on your show again.
Thank you. We also have Terry L. joining us, and Terry is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's been sober for 45 years and lives in Victoria. Hi, Terry.
Hi, Angela. Thanks for the invitation. Hi, Dr. Lee. How are you doing this morning?
All right. Thank you, both of you. And, you know, Dr. Lee, let's start with some of these studies. Studies show that Americans are drinking more through the pandemic. Does this line up with your experiences? Is that what you're seeing and hearing?
It absolutely does. It lines up with what we're seeing on the ground, lines up with historical trends as well. We know that in times of stress, people tend to consume more substances as a way to cope and for other reasons, due to a lot of the things that they're going through, difficult hardships. There was a really good study done by the RAND Corporation that suggested what you all have already said, that adults are drinking more, heavy drinking is increasing. And interestingly, there are subpopulations in that data that we have to pay attention to, especially women.
And what is going on with women? I mentioned binge drinking in women has gone up. You know, I've read lots of reports about women, just in general, how women are bearing the brunt of the pandemic in many ways in terms of job losses and childcare, remote work and school. So what can you tell us about what is happening with women in alcohol?
Well, I agree with your point that I think what COVID has revealed is that women really are the pillars of holding our society together. And I think they are under a tremendous amount of pressure to get everything done, from virtual schooling and maintaining family environments to working and maintaining their careers. And I think it's been very burdensome. So we see a disconnect even at Hazelden Betty Ford in that we would have predicted more women seeking treatment. And we see that while the numbers across the country are going up, I think a lot of women have a lot on their plates and are having a hard time accessing help and having breathing room. But the trend with women around the country has been an insidious one and has been going on prior to COVID. In fact, in the UK and in the US over the past 3 or 4 decades, college-educated women in particular, drinking rates have escalated rather alarmingly, and that trend has continued. And my hypothesis there is really clever marketing designed towards women who now have greater access to financial equity. And so they're targeting female populations, and you're seeing that increase. And you see it everywhere. The marketing for rosé wine, discussions of cliches about mommy juice or, you know, wine moms. And on the one hand, these are funny. On the other hand, there is kind of a predatory economic component that we should pay attention to from a public health standpoint.
Terry, you've been sober for 45 years, which is wonderful. During that time, you attended AA meetings. So tell me, has the stress of the pandemic made it much more difficult to stay sober?
Not for me. And I think for the majority, no. And the reason has largely to do with AA's ability to adapt to change. And we quickly moved many, many AA meetings to a what we call a Zoom environment. It's a video online environment. And those meetings started popping up very quickly in the early part of the pandemic. And they, I checked with our local office here, our information office, and they have over 250 Zoom AA meetings listed in their directory in this immediate geography. So that's the avenue today rather than going to in-person meetings.
So in some ways, I mean, this has made probably AA more accessible to a lot of people. It's easier to tap into it and to give it a try or to attend meetings more regularly because of the virtual events. Are you seeing that?
Yeah, absolutely, Angela. The ability to get to meetings is instead of me driving a half hour to get to my favorite meeting on Thursday nights, I walk downstairs with a cup of coffee in my hand and go to my computer. So it's very easy for us, those of us who've been around for a long time. But also, it's there are lots and lots of newcomers to Alcoholics Anonymous that have various restrictions and where they can go and how they can travel, and they're without a driver's license and that sort of thing. So it's opened the doors wider, I think, for newcomers to be able to begin with Alcoholics Anonymous.
Terry, explain what is valuable in those conversations. What is helpful in those AA meetings for the people who attend?
We share our strength, hope, and experience with each other so that we can help each other get and stay sober. Mm-hmm. So we're part of a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. So it's I have a new guy that I'm working with who has never been to an in-person AA meeting, by the way. And Brian just mentioned the other day, he said, I'm one of the few people that he's talked to that are not giving him grief about his drinking or his recent bad behavior or the trouble he's gotten into. And we don't do that. We're cheerleaders for each other. We're here to try to help each other to live good lives and stay away from a drink. So the most valuable things are personal interactions.
And Terry, you heard what Dr. Lee and I were just talking about, the studies showing more people are drinking to cope with the stress of the pandemic. Are you seeing that among folks you know who are not in recovery and who consider themselves to simply be social drinkers?
You know, I haven't really, because I'm quarantining myself largely, and so I'm not seeing a lot of drinking parties, although my next-door neighbors look like they were having a good time a couple weeks ago. So I really can't comment on that, but what I would say is our intergroup offices, both in Minneapolis and St. Paul, have reported that they're getting twice the calls that they were getting prior to the pandemic, which is a significant increase in number of people calling for information about AA meetings. But more importantly, new people saying, how do I get help from Alcoholics Anonymous? Mm-hmm. And it's dramatically increased. So I think this being the pandemic has put people in a position where the problem may be a little more exposed.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I'm living really close with my wife right now. And if I was drinking, she'd know it, you know.
Right. And I should mention, you can find the nearest Alcoholics Anonymous support group at this website. It's aa.org. We are talking about drinking and consuming alcohol. And if you have a question about how much is too much, if you drink regularly, if you're concerned about a loved one who may be drinking too much during the pandemic, if you're in recovery and having a hard time, we want to hear from you. The number is 651-227-6000. And as we talk with guests, we want to talk to some of our listeners. Let's take a phone call right now. In White Bear Lake, Kathy is on the phone. Good morning to you, Kathy.
Hi there.
Hi. What did you want to share with us?
I just want to say I've been free from alcohol for 5 years. And one of the only things that has really helped me get through all of this time, and especially right now, is planning. So I know that a certain time of day, which is in the evening at home for me, is a hard time. Mm-hmm. If you know when your hard times are, plan anything. It could be a book, a long phone call with somebody. I've been visiting my daughter. We've kind of decided that we're going to be in the bubble together. Mm-hmm. So I go to visit her a lot in the evening, maybe between 8 and 10, which is one of my hard times. Mm-hmm. So planning is huge. I'm not up for all the Zoom meetings particularly. I kind of tried those and they weren't, you know, really rewarding for me. But planning is huge. And I know a lot of my friends have, you know, sunk a little deeper into the alcohol use during this time. And that's the biggest thing I can share is, you know, if you can plan ahead when you know that you're going to have a problem.
I like that strategy. But Kathy, tell me more about what you're hearing from people that you know. You mentioned that they are sharing that they feel like they're drinking more.
Well, that's one of the things, too, is when, I mean, I used to drink at home alone because I figured I wasn't hurting anyone, you know. I wasn't out driving around, and but I was hurting myself, of course. So, you know, my friends who are single like I am and who are, you know, living alone and, you know, stuck at home with, you know, their vices.
Yeah, it's isolating. Yeah.
That's why I'm hearing, I think, more of that, just because, right, everybody's in the same boat and it affects people who are, you know, more inclined to have a problem, you know, much more.
Well, Kathy, in White Bear Lake, thank you, Kathy, for calling in and sharing that. I do appreciate it. Dr. Lee, what do you think about this, what she just shared about planning, having an activity plan for when you know are the hours that you're most likely to drink?
Yeah, I really appreciate Kathy sharing. And I love the fact that I always get to provide the nerdy color commentary on your show. And I think there's a lot of science.
I don't think you're nerdy. I think you're very helpful. I'm sorry you feel that way.
I appreciate that. There's a lot of science behind what Kathy's saying. So what she's talking about are identifying triggers. And so one term we might use is doing like a functional analysis of someone's drinking. So regardless of any labels or the severity of alcohol use disorder, if anyone feels like their drinking is a little bit out of hand, they may want to pay attention to external and internal triggers that key them in on moments, memories internally, external situations, times of the day that are repeated patterns of drinking. And then what she's doing is she's inserting what we call a pro-social alternative, another way to have fun that distracts you and takes you, your mind off of that trigger. And so what she's doing is incredibly scientific, though it may not feel like it, and it can be very successful.
All right, let's take another phone call. In Anoka, we have Chris on the line. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. I just wanted to mention I'm an executive director of a nonprofit organization that does peer support and recovery for people with mental health issues and substance use disorders. And we have definitely seen an uptick in contacts to our organization from people in general around the rise in anxiety and depression associated very much with isolation that came with the lockdown, and a lot of people turning to alcohol and drugs as a coping mechanism, very often for people who might never have used those substances as a means for coping before. But we know that because of the prevalence of alcohol in our society and the ease of access to those things, especially when they were deemed a essential service during the pandemic, that even people like ourselves who are trained, I'm a certified peer recovery specialist and peer support specialist, as most of the people in our organization, but we also had somebody within our organization who struggled with the anxiety over job loss and what was happening with children, and fell victim to relapses with her alcohol use, and led to a DWI, which had not been something that had been a problem in her life for over 5 years.
And Chris, you say you are an executive director of a peer recovery support organization. And I've been wondering, you know, just about, you know, I think everybody's support system is really just not what it used to be, because so many of our close family and friends, they're all struggling as well. So what can you tell us about, you know, what people are getting out of peer support, having somebody to talk to about their struggles?
Well, I think much like your other guest spoke about in what they get out of going to AA meetings, and even if it is online, which I think we all recognize the fact that not everyone is necessarily comfortable with that model of quote-unquote connecting, but in a peer recovery model, you know, it really finding an ear of someone who is non-judgmental in what's going on with that person. And very often the people who, especially when we close our circle of connection down so much, and it might just be people who are our family around, we don't necessarily get a non-judgmental ear. Mm-hmm. Far too often we're expected to, hey, you know, suck it up and just you have to live your life and get on with things and get over it. Everybody has a hard time and those kind of things. So to talk to somebody who has that lived experience, who understands what an addiction means and how that can really rip through your life and those of the lives around you, and to just be able to listen and not give advice and not say, well, you know, if you only did this, but help that person understand where they do have some power in this time that everyone feels very out of control.
Yes. Yes, that's Chris Inanoka. Thank you for calling in, Chris. If you're just joining us, we're talking about alcohol consumption during the pandemic, and I want to hear your stories. The number to call is 651-227-6000. You can tweet me at Angela Davis, MPR. Let's take another phone call as we talk with two guests. We have Dr. Joseph Lee on the line, who is the medical director for Hazelden Betty Ford Youth Continuum, as well as Terry, who's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and Terry's been sober for 45 years now. In St. Paul right now, let's talk to Elizabeth, who's holding on. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, Angela. Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to share my experience that I am a member of AA, but during COVID, the challenge was staying sober. The isolation, working from home, I mean, just not even having physical contact really impacted my ability to stay in recovery and stay sober.
And so what has happened during these months? What have you turned to? What have you been able to do?
Well, first of all, I, for the first time, went into inpatient treatment, mm-hmm. which was a challenge in and of itself, because I think with the higher rates, it took quite a bit of time to find a spot in in-person treatment. But mm-hmm. I think that was helpful. I had to have that little extra piece of momentum to be able to get back on track. And then after getting out of inpatient, intense outpatient therapy, as well as returning back to AA, got two sponsors. So those are the things that I've been doing. And being honest with family, even though some of them are anxious, at least being more honest with friends and family of what I'm going through and the emotions and the stress.
And Elizabeth, we don't know how many more months of living through, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic and all the changes it has brought. We don't know how many months we have ahead in this situation. So what are your thoughts? How are you processing about how you're going to get through it and to stay sober?
Yeah, I think that sticking with the outpatient, so that's three nights a week, and then continue with AA and continue to stay in touch with my sponsor is going to be the way to go. It was actually quite wonderful to be an inpatient because there was contact, there was interaction, and I'm single. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's one thing if you have a husband or a family member in the household, but it was pretty lonely for me. So I'm going to use those tools as coping mechanisms in order to get through.
All right. That's Elizabeth calling in St. Paul. Thank you for sharing your story, Elizabeth. And I'm wishing you the best in the months to come. Terry, as you hear her story, you know, what do you hear there and what Elizabeth just shared? She was in recovery and she, you know, fell back into drinking.
That happens, unfortunately. The thing that I always suggest to people that I'm working with and people who are interested in listening is active, enthusiastic participation in Alcoholics Anonymous. And by that, in these days, I mean things like having a sponsor and talking with your sponsor on a regular basis. So the new guy that I'm working with calls me every day about 3:00. We visit a little bit. Sometimes it's short. Sometimes it's a little longer. We talk about anything that's bugging him and just the state of the nation or whatever is on his mind, and we go on. So we have regular connection. I also recommend for new people to go to a meeting every day. And I did that when I was totally sober, and the meetings were plentiful where I sobered up, and they're still plentiful today in terms of being able to make meetings by way of Zoom. And if you go to a Zoom meeting and you're new, then you can just simply ask if somebody would be able to sponsor them. Mm-hmm. Having that sponsor can really make a big difference in terms of providing a relationship to rely on and also information about how best to handle your days.
And Dr. Lee, what would you add to that?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of great things Elizabeth is sharing. I love how Elizabeth talks about her return to use or some difficulties maintaining sobriety without any shame. And so she's taken the moral element out of it, the labeling element out of it. And you hear somebody really talking about a medical condition. And one of the things we always say in our youth continuum treatment is people know themselves the best. And Elizabeth knows herself the best. She's humble and honest with her family. She knew what she needed was some interaction. And so she got the help she needed. And so you hear stories like that time and again, that once people have some foundational skills in recovery, they know how to get help. They're very resilient and they're incredibly resourceful. And another thing that I'd share is, you know, what you've heard from Terry so far is not an uncommon story either. A lot of people in recovery are extremely resilient. What people are experiencing in society today now with COVID, with all the isolation and despair, the loneliness, the uncertainty, finding hope, knowing the power of connecting with other people, these are concepts that people in recovery are very familiar with. They've been through this before. So you actually see many people also, like Terry, who are incredibly resilient and are surprisingly thriving, or maybe not surprisingly thriving, in moments like this. And so our conversation today isn't just about alcohol use disorder per se, though. So there are people who've increased their drinking. It does not mean you have an alcohol use disorder, the severe form of which is what conversationally we call addiction. And there's many ways to get help. But I think it's great to just start with an honest conversation with yourself, because I think if you really look in the mirror, break down the walls of isolation through the power of storytelling that your guests and callers are sharing, I think maybe more people will get help or take an inventory of what's happening with themselves.
This conversation about alcohol consumption during the pandemic is part of Call to Mind, which is NPR's initiative to foster new conversations about mental health. You can learn more at calltomindnow.org. And also, if you're interested in learning more about Alcoholics Anonymous, you can find more info at their website. It is aa.org. In Minnetonka, let's talk to Lane, who's been holding on. Thank you for your patience, Lane.
Hi, I'm calling just because I have a question about maybe supporting someone that you're worried about during this pandemic, drinking more, mm-hmm. specifically my husband. I'm just wondering what you would suggest I do to encourage him to lower his consumption.
All right, that's Lane. And Dr. Lee, if you want to help someone that you're concerned about, what can you do?
Yeah, I think there's quite a bit that you can do. One of the many examples, but probably the best studied, is a therapy called CRAFT, Community Reinforcement Approach to Family Training. And so it's called CRAFT. You can Google CRAFT. And it's actually empowering family members to help their loved ones get help. And it actually has evidence to not just reduce substance use in the loved one that you're concerned about, but also helps with your quality of life and improves our chances of actually seeking treatment. So that might be a good resource to look into. Our family services, for example, use CRAFT at an increasing rate, and we find it to be highly successful there as well. And getting that family help, getting some help for yourself, I think is good. It's important to remain positive and to catch them doing something right instead of having a more moralistic or punitive approach, with the caveat being that you want to make sure that, you know, he's safe, that other people are safe, that there aren't dangerous situations. And so there's a lot of hope for you. There's a lot of science based on people who are in your position. And so I would continue at it. Try to seek professional help. Try to seek some guidance. CRAFT therapy, if you were to engage in it, would start with you for a number of sessions without your loved one to build your skill sets. And so I see a lot of good things ahead for you if you keep plowing along.
And Terry, I know that you're married. What advice would you have for Elaine who wants to help her husband?
That's a very difficult thing to deal with, of course. And I was alcoholic. If my wife brought up my drinking, I mean, when I was drinking, if she brought that up, it was always grounds for battle. So I know that's difficult. But I'd also want to mention, in addition to the resources that Dr. Lee has mentioned, the Al-Anon family groups are designed to help people who are concerned about a family member's drinking, particularly a spouse, but also friends and family. Al-Anon is Al-Anon. You can find it in the phone book. And you can learn more about the disease of alcoholism and how best to deal with it for yourself.
Let's take another phone call in Rochester. Alex is on the line. Good morning, Alex.
Hi. So I'm calling because due to COVID, I'm back home from college and I'm living with my parents. And I'm working at the same store with my mom because we're essential. So we have more of a regular schedule, but my dad doesn't. He works on the railroad. So he's kind of like at home for weird hours and gone for weird hours. Mm-hmm. We all drink though. And we have had this kind of honest conversation that Dr. Lee talked about that, you know, my dad is kind of drinking a little bit more, and it is something that we are kind of worried about. And so my question is, how do we, you know, support my dad without having to, like, completely cut off my mom and I? Because, like, you know, it is stressful and it is, like, hard being at home all the time, and I'm still going to school online, so mm-hmm. I don't want to like completely cut myself off from this, if that makes sense. I know that's really selfish.
I understand.
But.
No, I understand. Dr. Lee, what advice do you have for Alex in his 20s and has a concern about his father as he's now back living at home with his parents?
Yeah, Alex, thank you so much for calling and sharing, because I think many people in the audience can connect with your story. Mm-hmm. You know, I think just because a loved one decides to stop drinking or cut down significantly doesn't mean that other family members need to necessarily. But sometimes you will find when you do a scientific analysis of drinking in the family that alcohol being present in the home is a trigger. And so I would say for now, let's not cross that road. I would start with the beginning. Maybe having a positive conversation with your father, getting an assessment, just having some screening to just get a pulse on, you know, how big of an issue is this? You know, sharing your concerns with mom, again, staying positive about it, seeking some professional help yourself. Al-Anon, as Terry mentioned, is another great resource. And then you'll be able to find other people and experts who understand your place in your journey and your context. And so I wouldn't lead with a fear that you have to cut yourself off. I certainly wouldn't feel selfish about it. There are many people in recovery whose family members continue to drink because they don't really have much of a problem. And so cross that road when it comes to it. But I think you're doing the right thing, asking yourself, what's the next right step? And I think the next right step is maybe having an assessment, maybe having some screening done for your father and inviting those open conversations.
Terry, I know you have young adult children. Back when you were drinking, were they aware that you were drinking too much?
No, they were pretty young. My mm-hmm. daughter was, I think, 5 years old when I stopped drinking. So, but I think, you know, they were aware that there was an awful lot of ruckus going on in the household. So,
mm-hmm. And so what advice do you have for Alex, a young man in his 20s, concerned about his dad?
I would again repeat the advice or the offer of Al-Anon information and support. And it, like I said, it's very difficult to deal with it. But if there were a moment when dad might be listening, he's welcome to attend any open AA meeting. And the majority of AA meetings are open. And he can go and just be a spectator and see if what he hears there fits.
Can you be a spectator on a Zoom event? I mean, you could do a virtual meeting and yep. not have your camera yep. on. Is that an option?
Yes, that's true. Yeah. And you don't have to use your name. We're the majority of the people do use their first and last name so that we're, you know, we get to know each other. And we're not really anonymous within AA. But for open people who have a concern about anonymity or, you know, not right. sure they want to be there, they don't need to use their name. They don't need to use their camera. They can just go and listen.
And Dr. Lee, how much is too much? I mean, can we put numbers around, like, what's okay to drink and what's considered not a problem, what's considered excessive? And because I feel like it depends on if you're a man or a woman and your body weight as well, right?
It does depend on whether you're a man or a woman. And the government has actually come up with some numbers. Now, it's not as if you exceed these numbers, your head's going to explode right away. These are numbers that are not completely arbitrary either. They're based on studies, and they found that people who drink under a certain amount are less likely to develop an alcohol use disorder in the future. So binge drinking is considered 5 or more drinks for a male adult in one sitting. And for females, it's 4 drinks. But the government is now saying really moderation is 1 drink per night for a woman and 2 for a man. And that's what they're suggesting. And that more than that could be the signs that you're developing some problem. And again, you don't have to use the word addiction per se, but it may be affecting your life in a negative way. It might invite a conversation with your primary care doctor or a further assessment. That 2 drink for men, 1 drink for women guideline is also not intended to mean that you can then drink 2 drinks every night if you're a man. It's just saying on a given night, you know, 2 drinks would be moderation, 1 drink for women. And we've seen those numbers increase. And so I think if people are concerned, they just have a gut feeling or they're hearing from other people and their loved ones that, hey, you know, we all like to have a good time, like Terry's neighbors might, but we're a little bit concerned, then they should try to seek some counsel. And finally, to add a little scientific bit to what Terry has been saying, because there's been a lot of science in this, the most rigorous review of literature and research called the Cochrane Review, done by Dr. John Kelly at Harvard, that came out just before COVID, showed pretty conclusively that Alcoholics Anonymous and treatments based on Alcoholics Anonymous, though not the only choice for people if they don't self-select for it, is highly effective for helping people with alcohol use problems. And so there's a scientific basis to what Terry has been sharing all program long.
Let's take a phone call from another listener in Esco. Kyle is on the phone. Good morning to you, Kyle.
Hi, Angela. Thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate it. Appreciate this conversation from everybody. I am a person who was found myself drinking increasingly more as kind of COVID progressed and quarantine set in, and then quit. So I'm newly sober, about 150 days now, and just wanted to share a little bit about how that came to be, mm-hmm. because it was really strange to me how quarantine and my anxiety and all of that helped it progress. So I had always been a casual drinker, never had been problematic, but just being home all day, every day, just found myself drinking more and more. And I remember sitting by the pool with my kids this summer, early this summer, and it was like 11 a.m. on a Wednesday or something. And I looked down, it was like out-of-body experience, had a drink in my hand. Mm-hmm. And I went, wow, I think it has become a problem for me. I talked with my partner. I said, do you, she was wonderful. She's been wonderful the whole time. I said, do you think I have a drinking problem? And she said, you know, I can't answer that for you, but I do notice that you have not been fully present. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's not something that I would ever want for my partner or my kids, or frankly for myself. And, the interesting thing is, like, through my journey and conversations with many people and many friends and all kinds of folks making different decisions around drinking, a lot of people close to me have been feeling that same thing, that we're just a little bit less present in our lives.
Mm-hmm. The behavior changes. Thank you, Kyle. And I wish you the best as we continue to get through these very difficult months. And Terry, what do you hear in Kyle's story?
Well, success. He's sober 150 days. Mm-hmm. And but I didn't hear exactly how he's doing it. The one thing I did think was, like, to invite Kyle to any of the meetings that I attend. And hopefully we'll cross paths. If you ever see Terry L. on a Zoom meeting, I'm happy to visit with you and show you around.
And Dr. Lee, he described, you know, 11 a.m. in the morning and recognizing, almost having like an out-of-body experience, like, what am I doing here? Is that something you hear frequently from patients?
Yeah, not everybody has the kind of epiphanies that Kyle does. And so I want to thank him for sharing his story, and I hope it's an inspiration for other people. But we do get a fair number of people where they have that aha moment where they're looking at the lay of the land, all the cards on the table, whatever metaphor you want to use. And what Kyle's talking about really is how we gently guide people in therapy towards the same conclusion that he's reached and had success with, which is, what are your values and who are you? What kind of person are you? And Kyle talked about being the right kind of partner, being the right kind of father, and that there was something about him that was missing when drinking started to take more of a control in his life and that other people noticed it. And that was not who he was. Mm-hmm. And that helped him return to center. And that's the process that we use actually in psychotherapy quite a bit, to get people through the connection of AA through other sources sober.
So you can catch yourself. You can say, like, you know what? This is not who I normally am. And you can correct it.
That's right. That's right. Sometimes, you know, as human beings, if you buy a pair of shoes, we have a tendency to believe that the pair of shoes we bought are the best, you know? And so we have a way of rationalizing our current context. Some people are in abusive relationships and they rationalize it, and even if they're miserable. So we have a hard time with change as human beings. But fundamentally, when people are in a non-judgmental, empathic environment like AA, or sometimes with family members, they have tremendous insight into themselves. People really do know themselves the best. And within them, they have the keys, they have the solutions. And so other people, that connection, that empathy and non-judgment helps to unlock that.
Back to the phones in Minnetonka. Helen is on the phone. Good morning to you, Helen.
Good morning, and thanks for taking my call. I'm giving a warning to seniors who might have had a pretty active life prior to the COVID lockup and were maybe volunteering or attending events. And when you don't have that, when you don't have something to take your mind off your aches and pains, pretty soon you start to recognize the fact that maybe my arthritis is flaring, maybe I've got arthritis in the back or my back hurts or my, you know, and and a sherry in the afternoon maybe takes care of that. And maybe then, oh, I felt so much better. I didn't have my aches and pains. Maybe I'll do a glass of wine, a couple glasses of wine. And you can slide into this overuse. And I think it's a really dangerous time for seniors, especially singles. So be aware of that. And don't ever drink to stop the physical pain. Find something else to do. Call somebody or help somebody. Or, you know, it may not be as active a lifestyle as you want, but if you're locked away, it's maybe time to go through, you know, divert your attention to something else so that you feel your pains less.
Thank you. That's Helen in Minnetonka. Nobody wants to tell grandma or grandpa what to do. And so I imagine that's a difficult conversation if you were worried about, you know, a senior in your life. Terry, what would you say to what Helen just shared about seniors drinking more?
You know, I hate to sound like a broken record, but if you're worried about a family member, old or young, the best place to learn more is to go to Al-Anon. And, you know, my job as an AA member is to try to help drunks get and stay sober. And so I try to stick with that.
Dr. Lee, what do we know about older folks? Is it easy for them to slip into this pattern? You know, she talked about, you know, having some aches and pains.
It is. I mean, I think the quarantining, the isolation, the fear of getting an infection, mounting medical conditions. I think that it's easy to see a narrative where someone is coping or quote unquote self-medicating through the use of alcohol, but alcohol only compounds the problems in the long run, you know? And so when people are self-medicating, they feel like it's the opposite of an addiction or a substance use disorder. But actually, people who use substances to cope or change their emotions too much, if you line them up, they are the people who are actually at high risk for developing addiction. And so elderly need to be especially careful, not only because of the impacts of addiction, but the impacts on their physical health, their relationships, it will magnify their isolation. So good advice from Helen.
And Doctor, in just our last 30 seconds here, I imagine you've seen many success stories. So do you have some encouraging words for our audience?
There's so much hope and love out there for people, regardless of what you would classify yourself. If you have worries about drinking, there are millions of people who, just like Terry, who've done it in various ways. And there's so much support and help for you. And through this COVID pandemic, I hope we never forget the importance and the power of human connection.
Yes.
And how important that is to get people to heal and connect. And I think it's a great opportunity. We're all suffering together. But perhaps this is a great lesson and we can come out on the other side as a better society.
Thank you, both of you, for your time today. I appreciate it. And thank you to all of our callers who shared such personal stories. To our guest today, Dr. Joseph Lee, Medical Director at Hazelden Betty Ford Youth Continuum, and Terry L., a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you want more information, you can go to AA.org. This conversation was produced by NPR's Arfi Getty and Katie Moritz.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. To add your voice to the conversation, you can call in at 651-289-4488. 877-227-6000 or tweet us at Angela Davis NPR. And if you missed us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. Thanks for listening.